The University of Montana must find another $9 million to cut. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. We'll also tell you about a megalode protester arrested in Missoula. And in our feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce talks to longtime newspaper reporter Eve Byron about why she's leaving the business. The University of Montana must find another $9 million to cut in the coming year, on top of the $6 million cut from the current year's budget. President Royce Angstrom outlined the budget woes in a letter to the campus community today. Vice President Mike Reed says although the number of non-resident students are up, it's not as many as they had expected or hoped for, and that means fewer tuition dollars.
Just this fall semester alone, that was approximately a little over $2 million in revenue we'd anticipated from that one category of students. And so that's why we're dealing with the issues in 2014, was really that specific group. Some of the other areas were down, but that's the major area.
The university has already cut several one-time expenditures, but Reed says further cuts are necessary. That includes implementing what the administration is calling a, quote, hiring chill to try to save money.
So if there's a position that becomes vacant, either through somebody's moving on, they're retiring, or they're taking a position elsewhere, rather than just filling that position, we evaluate every position. We look at it and say, is this something that could be consolidated into another department? Is this a service that we really even need to continue to do? Could it be done differently? And we look at that position and we try to figure out, are there ways we could do without this position so that we don't end up needing to hire that role?
Instruction could also be affected as some courses with low enrollment may be dropped. Some adjunct faculty could be cut, and tenured faculty may be required to teach more beginning courses.
We have fewer students. We have fewer sections that we need to run, and so there probably will be some compression there. And the way they're going to have to do that is really look at where the demand for the sections are and make sure that the classes are full and just manage that. And I know that the provost and the deans and that group are, you know, looking very seriously at how they manage that operation. But it's really a matter of structuring and resizing the institution so that we're taking care of the number of students that we have today.
Meanwhile, the university is doing all it can to recruit new students and boost enrollment, but Reed says that effort will take time to pay off. And in other news from around the state, the Copper King Hotel and Convention Center in Butte is closing Sunday night, putting 50 people out of work. Sales Director Marilyn Polich confirmed the closure of the hotel, bar, and restaurant to the Montana Standard yesterday. Owner Ken Burningham of Seattle did not return phone calls to the newspaper seeking comment. Burningham has been trying to sell the hotel at least since 2008, when it was listed at $6 million. Butte Local Development Corporation Director Jim Smitham said Burningham now wants a little over $2 million. The Copper King closed in October 2008, putting 75 people out of work. Burningham talked about demolishing it in 2009, but found the cost would be too high. A group of investors reopened the hotel in 2010, but Burningham took back ownership when their financing fell through. A Montana jury has awarded an office supply manufacturer $52 million in its lawsuit against its former bank. Masters Group International Incorporated sued Comerica Incorporated after the bank reneged on a November 2008 agreement to delay collection of a $10.5 million line of credit, while Masters negotiated another credit line that required it not be in default with Comerica. Masters attorney Timothy Strach told the Missoulian that Comerica took all $9 million from Masters' accounts in December 2008, effectively leading to the death of the company, which had planned to open a distribution center in Butte. The lawsuit began when the Butte Local Development Corporation sought to recoup a $200,000 loan it made to Masters Group in 2006. Masters brought Comerica in as a third-party defendant. Dallas-based Comerica says it may appeal Friday's verdict. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee will hold a hearing next Tuesday on President Barack Obama's pick of retiring Senator Max Baucus to serve as ambassador to China. The six-term Democratic senator is expected to sail toward confirmation by his colleagues. If confirmed, Baucus would replace Gary Locke, who has announced plans to leave the diplomatic post. Baucus has served in the Senate for more than two decades. Obama announced the nomination last year. Baucus decided not to seek re-election to another term. and Democratic Governor Steve Bullock will get to name a replacement. The Air Force's top civilian leader is in North Dakota to finish a tour of the three military bases that house the nation's nuclear arsenal. Air Force Secretary Deborah Lee James visited F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming yesterday and Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls yesterday and this morning. She finished the fact-finding tour this afternoon at Minot Air Force Base. It's the latest in a string of stops from high-level officials in response to various blunders at the military installations that care for the nation's nuclear arsenal. The trip is in response to cheating and drug scandals the Air Force announced last week, as well as other missteps the Associated Press revealed last year. It's aimed at finding the breadth of problems within the force. A 71-year-old Missoula woman was arrested after sitting on the road in the path of a huge load of oil field equipment moving through Missoula early this morning. The Missoulian reports Carol Marsh was cited for misdemeanor disorderly conduct, and the load continued on to Bonner, where it will stay for 2 weeks while it is reconfigured and loaded onto a different trailer to meet the requirements of Canadian highways. The equipment is bound for Fort McMurray, Alberta. Missoula Police Detective Sergeant Travis Welsh said protesters along Reserve Street were generally peaceful as the load moved through town. A Montana Highway Patrol officer accompanying the rig called police at about 12:40 a.m. to report someone was sitting in the road. Marsh was also arrested 2 years ago in a similar protest. Prosecutors have netted a string of guilty pleas among the suspects in an interstate drug trafficking case that highlighted the criminal underside of an oil boom sweeping the Northern Plains. The latest suspect is Robert Farrell Armstrong of Moses Lake, Washington, described by authorities as the supplier for a large methamphetamine ring in the Bakken oil patch. He was scheduled to appear in federal court in Billings today to plead guilty to possession of methamphetamine with intent to distribute. He faces a minimum 10 years in prison. Armstrong was arrested in October in a crackdown aimed at offsetting rising crime in the oil-producing region along the Montana-North Dakota border. Nine others have pleaded guilty in related cases in Montana. Several cases in North Dakota remain pending. A man who was arrested in Montana for violating his parole in a California case has waived extradition, but not before hitting his public defender. The Billings Gazette reports 32-year-old David Anthony Aguilar appeared in justice court yesterday by video from the Yellowstone County Jail when he raised his handcuffed hands and hit public defender Eric Moore on the side of the head, causing a small cut. The Gazette reports officers could be seen rushing to restrain Aguilar. Moore left and a second public defender took over. Aguilar waived extradition, clearing the way for law enforcement officers from California to pick him up. It was not clear why he was wanted in California. The Yellowstone County Attorney's Office said today that no additional charges were immediately filed against Aguilar. A Shelby doctor is fighting the hospital board's decision to revoke his privileges over frequent bullying of staff members. The Great Falls Tribune reports Dr. Robert Clary filed a complaint in district court on January 16th, alleging Marias Medical Center violated its own bylaws during its investigation of the allegations made against him. He argued he was not given the opportunity to request a hearing or appeal the decision. Clary is seeking a permanent injunction prohibiting the Shelby Hospital from changing his hospital privileges, which were revoked on January 15th. A hearing is set for Friday in district court in Shelby. A letter from the hospital's CEO to the chief of the medical staff was included in Clary's complaint. It cited a vulgarity-laced disruption in the operating room in December and other issues. Authorities in northern Idaho say the body of a missing 18-year-old man from Kellogg has been found. The Shoshone County Sheriff's Office says two local men searching for an all-terrain vehicle that rolled off a road found the body of Dylan Parker yesterday in a ravine in the 2 Mile Gulch area near Osborne. Parker was last seen in Osborne and was reported missing January 12th when he didn't meet his mother to be picked up at a gas station following a party. Parker previously lived in Columbus, Montana. Shoshone County Under Sheriff Rod Plank says an autopsy is planned and investigators will try to determine how Parker ended up in the ravine. A Laurel man convicted for a drunken road rage crash that left two people with permanent injuries has been sentenced to 5 years with the Department of Corrections, with two suspended. The Billings Gazette reports 36-year-old Jeremy Todd Fake was sentenced yesterday in district court. Vick was convicted of assault with a weapon, criminal endangerment, and misdemeanor DUI for using his pickup truck to repeatedly hit a sport utility vehicle in Laurel in November 2012, and then pulling out a pistol and firing a shot. A woman who was in the SUV said she has post-traumatic stress disorder, suffers migraines, and has permanent nerve damage in her hands. Vick said his wife called him and said she had been chased by the SUV. The victim said Kristen Vick tried to run them off the road. A mother and daughter are charged with breaking into a home, stealing numerous items, and beating the woman who lived there when she tried to prevent them from leaving. The Billings Gazette reports 54-year-old Kimberly Polk and 31-year-old Sherry Scheidel were charged with felony aggravated burglary yesterday in justice court. They remain jailed today, Polk on $20,000 bond and Scheidel on $15,000 bond. Their district court arraignments are set for January 28th. Charging documents say the victim returned home Friday to find the defendants there. She said she was knocked to the ground, hit at least four times with a hammer, and may have been hit with brass knuckles. Police reviewed security footage from the residence that showed the two women ransacking the house and assaulting a woman who confronted them. A man has pleaded guilty to threatening a teller during a 2012 bank robbery that netted just over $9,800. The Billings Gazette reports 42-year-old Joseph Anthony Ferrara pleaded guilty to felony robbery yesterday. Ferrara was identified about 6 hours after First Interstate Bank was robbed on August 21, 2012. A woman said she had twice taken him to the bank earlier that day because he said he had a wire transfer to pick up but was unable to. She said she borrowed her car. She said he borrowed her car when she went to work. She said he later called and left a message saying he was in a lot of trouble and telling her where her car was. Ferrara remains jailed on $100,000 bond. Sentencing is set for March 25th. Reporter Eve Byron has been a major force at the Helena Independent Record for decades. Starting out covering local government, Byron moved to being a journalistic authority on wildlife and natural resource issues in Montana. After 20 years and about 15,000 stories, Byron left the Independent Record last Friday. She's starting a new position as a communications specialist for the Helena-based nonprofit National Institute on Money in State Politics. In tonight's feature interview, Byron speaks with Capitol reporter Dan Boyce about a life in Montana journalism and how the changing nature of the industry is leading her to pursue other interests.
Eve, I wanted to start where you started. What was it that sparked an interest in journalism for you?
Apparently, I have a problem with authority, and that followed me through high school and followed me through college. But initially, actually, I went into nursing, and I thought I was going to kill somebody because my biology and chemistry grades were really bad. And I knew I liked to write and read, and I loved to question authority, and so it was just natural progression to become a journalist.
You graduated with a journalism degree from UC Boulder. You worked in Colorado for 10 years and then briefly in Minnesota for a number of papers before you moved to Helena in 1993. You originally began reporting city, county government. You did that for about 5 years. Just how well do you get to know a community? And then how well do you start to maybe appreciate the things that a small government does that most of us in our day-to-day lives don't even think about?
I can't go past certain houses where I've been to fires, to floods, to murders, to all sorts of various mayhem. It just, you really do get to know the community as well as the players and not just what decisions were made, but why they made those decisions.
You moved into covering natural resources and the federal government, and you spent a lot more time regularly with some of the most controversial issues in our state, a lot of them being wildlife issues, what to do with wolf management, bison management. Covering them for so long, what do you think it is about issues like wildlife issues in Montana that makes them so controversial every time the smallest decision is made?
I think it's because people are very passionate about wildlife, especially in Montana. It's part of the reason we live here. And that goes national and international because people project their feelings and their emotions on these animals, and they endow them with these human personalities where wolves are either these family, they mate for life, and they're these warm, cuddly things, or else they're the evil wolves in Little Red Riding Hood. and with the big teeth, and they're awfully nasty. And we just give them human characteristics, and it's very polarizing when you do that because they are none of these things that we put on them. They are wild animals, and they do what wild animals do, and that's survive. And while the stories may be about the critters, the stories really are about the people and people's reaction to the critters, whether you be an insider or an outsider.
So also in covering natural resources, you've also been able to see how the landscape in the Rocky Mountain West has changed in the years since you have started reporting. And that's particularly been the case with wildfires.
When I started down in Colorado, of course, that was in 87. We had had the fires of 88 here in Montana, but you didn't hear much about wildfires at all. And then we didn't have much to speak of in Montana when I moved here in 93. And then all of a sudden, it seemed in 2000, all hell broke loose. In Helena alone, we had the Bucksnort Cave Gulch fires, two fires start simultaneously. I ended up being evacuated, but still reported on that. I lived in the Bucksnort area. 2 weeks later, we had the Maud Latosten fires took off. 2 weeks after that, we had the Boulder High Ore fires. So that was six wildfires in Lewis and Clark, Jefferson, and Broadwater counties in a matter of 6 weeks. It was absolutely amazing. And at the end, everybody was thinking, well, what the hell was that? Especially since we mainly had the volunteer firefighters who were doing the initial response along with DNRC. DNRC would say after 24 hours, we need to pull back. We couldn't get Forest Service in here for another 48 hours. And you just had these guys, these accountants and fence stringers and the county sheriff. And all of a sudden, they're supposed to be protecting all of these houses and people's lives. And there's these huge wildfires. And it was absolutely crazy. Things were a little quieter in 01, then exploded in 03, exploded again in 2007. It's fascinating to see how we have evolved, how the first responders, all of those volunteer, now they work and train with the Forest Service, with DNRC. They've got mutual aid calls from various
DNRC, the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation.
Uh-huh. And also with the law enforcement and how they have embraced, as we have, the new multimedia in order to get the message out immediately when there are these emergency situations. And it amazes me, these people who run in and run toward the danger where everybody else is running away from it. I have so much respect for them.
So last week when you're leaving the Independent Record, you write a swan song of sorts. And the first thing you write here, you say, a former coworker told me a decade ago, there are two things you never want written about you in a newspaper, overcorrected on a curve and left to pursue other interests.
Well, you know what happens when you overcorrect on a curve. That'd be bad. And left to pursue other interests. So often when somebody gets fired or when they're told you need to resign now, the euphemism for that is they left to pursue other interests. And so I was one of the few lucky ones that I have a great new interest to pursue, which is along the same nonpartisan lines as I always have done. But yes, I am leaving to pursue other interests.
You write about journalism. I hope I'm just stepping aside until those who make the dollars make sense can come up with a new business model for this industry I love. What are your views of the journalism industry, particularly the journalism industry here in the state?
We have a lot of great new young journalists. We have a lot of really good older journalists, but I think there's been a significant brain drain. If you look at Gwen Florio, Ed Kemick, Mike Babcock, all of these people who know the issues and have been around for a long time and are relatively fearless have left because they see the handwriting on the wall. Journalism and newspapers are a three-legged stool. You have your classified ads, you have your display ads, and you have your circulation. Well, we got Craigslist, and that kicked out that classified ads leg. Then with the internet, all of a sudden the circulation issue arose, and newspapers aren't really sure what they're going to do and how they're going to reinvent themselves and what business model they can use now. But while we're trying those new things, the journalism that I came to know and love, which would be the in-depth investigative, sit down and create a spreadsheet and see where that information leads you, I haven't been able to do that for years. Well, maybe just a year. But there were stories sitting on my desk far too long that I needed to do and I couldn't do. And so I think it's a good time for people who don't know how we used to do things to try to develop these new models and these new ways of getting the information out there in a 24/7 news cycle. It's just not what I want to do and what the Ed Chemics and Gwen Florios of the world want to do.
Do you see that as being a concern for young people entering college as you did in the 1980s? Do you think the same types of people will be drawn to journalism that once were?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're still going to get the people who need to question everything. If your mother says she loves you, question it. That's always been the mantra. But I think more than that, the problem is when we get this kind of turnover in the newsrooms that we're not moving the conversation forward with the issues. We get these people who look at it and say, oh, look, it's something new and exciting. And they don't know that that already has been reported on and that has been discussed and cussed and resolved. And now we need to move the discussion forward. But instead, we're bound to repeat those conversations because the new reporters have to get educated and they don't have the old school there to say, we already did that story and we need to move forward with what's new for our customers and our readers, our subscribers.
Okay, finally, Eve, I wanted to talk to you about, you know, you wake up here on Monday, it's sort of your first day in a very long time, not being a working journalist. What is that morning like?
It was fabulous because it was Monday and it was Martin Luther King Day, and I didn't have to work because my new job has it off. I get all those national holidays off now, where I used to have to go into the office and realize that all of the state and federal agencies were going to be closed. Everybody was out playing except for me, and I needed to find something to fill that day's newspaper, the next day's newspaper, and I didn't have to do that anymore. And I kind of did a happy little dance and went out for coffee.
Fabulous. Well, I've been speaking with Eve Byron, longtime reporter for the Helena Independent Record, now working for the National Institute on Money in State Politics in Helena. Eve, thank you so much for your time. Such a great discussion.
My pleasure, Dan.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear, with patchy freezing fog and lows in the teens. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy. Also look for patchy freezing fog in the morning. High should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 8 p.m. tonight for the Rocky Mountain Front, Eastern Glacier, Cascade, Shoto, central and southern Lewis and Clark County, Tool, Eastern Ponderay, Eastern Teton, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Marr counties. Tonight should be partly cloudy with a chance of snow through the night and lows 5 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies, becoming sunny in the afternoon. Watch for patchy freezing fog in the morning, and highs should be 35 to 45 degrees. And in southwest Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 8 p.m. this evening for Broadwater and Gallatin counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the night. Low should be in the teens. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies in the morning that will become sunny as the day goes on. High should be in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the Area Agency on Aging for Missoula and Ravalli Counties. Tonight, I'd like to share some thoughts I have about the very important topic of planning for retirement. Like many of you, I'm beginning to think about when I might be able to retire. It's not that I've ignored the subject over the last 35 years. I diligently do my best to contribute to my retirement fund and annually monitor my expected Social Security income. But I always knew I needed to focus more attention on it. Recently, I utilized a great tool that helped me take a different perspective on planning for retirement. In this useful exercise, I looked at my current expenses and budget with a goal of figuring out my projected retirement income and expenses. It was a real eye-opener, making me realize some things I wish I had understood at the beginning of my career rather than waiting until now. Although my personal takeaways may or may not apply to your situation, I'd like to share a few in hopes that they may help someone along their road to retirement. The first takeaway is that I wish I had been more financially literate when I started my career. Like many of you, I rely on a broker to guide my investing. There's nothing wrong with this approach, but I wish I had better understood the language of investing and taken a more active role in making decisions. I can't be sure if this would have changed the outcome, but I now see the importance in terms of the many options we have to manage funds. This is especially true for those who are just starting their careers. Frankly, I think financial literacy should be emphasized starting in high school. My second big takeaway is the major role Social Security plays in my retirement plan. Although I had been monitoring my projected Social Security income for years, it wasn't until recently that I understood that without it, I would be in a world of hurt. As an advocate for Social Security, I've researched it and followed the discussions in Congress about proposed changes. Once I connected the dots between advocacy and me personally, it has been enlightening. I recently read an article from PolitiFact about what a person pays into Social Security compared with what a person will get out during their retirement years. While difficult to summarize because of the many different scenarios and because longevity has increased, in many cases, people get more from Social Security than they put in. In 1950, the average American lived for 68 years. Now the average life expectancy is 78, and many people live into their 80s, 90s, and beyond. Social Security continues to be a very important, and we need to be a part of the discussion for making it stronger. There are many ways to do this, but I'll save that for another commentary. It is critical that we all get educated about the issues surrounding Social Security from reliable sources, not politicians. Regardless of your age, most of us can't afford to be in the dark and not involved in this discussion. My final takeaway is the importance of examining your budget. I've never really operated on a budget because I'm frugal, especially in comparison to today's typical consumer. I always lived within my means and I have very little debt. That said, I wish I'd at least looked hard at my annual budget to know where my money was going and to determine how much more I could have put towards retirement. Like many people, I worried about locking too much money away. What I should have done earlier is the exercise of really evaluating what was necessary expenses versus choices in spending. I should have made retirement at least as important as saving for my child's future beyond high school. Our children may not understand our limited ability to support them after they graduate from high school, but they will get it when they don't have to provide financial support to us when we are old because we saved enough for retirement. I hope my comments will stimulate discussions in your family that will ultimately help you focus more on your retirement plan. These are just the observations of one person trying to figure this out. But because my career has involved working with people as they grow older and retire, I've seen many examples of how well it can work when the best plans are in place. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and as always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.